Good afternoon. I'm Gabriella Bloom. I'm the Rita E. Hauser Professor of Human Rights and International Humanitarian Law at Harvard Law School. It is my great privilege to host this panel, audaciously titled Repairing the World. And since we only have 1 hour to do so, we'd better get started. I have the honor of briefly introducing our three speakers and their three wonderfully inspiring books. I will do so shortly. Each of them will then speak for about 5 minutes to introduce their book and their key arguments. I will follow up with some questions afterwards, and I'll be sure to leave 15 minutes for your questions from the audience towards the end. No 15-minute discussion can possibly do justice to the breadth and richness of these works. I invite you to spend much more time with them, and the books are all available here for purchase after our session ends. So with us are Jacqueline Baba, Professor of the Practice of Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. She also is a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School and the Harvard Law School. She has published extensively on issues of citizenship, refugees, children's rights, citizenship. Her book, Child Migration and Human Rights in a Global Age, published by Princeton in 2014, is a combination of decades of Professor Baba's work as a human rights lawyer and a scholar. It calls our attention to the unique challenges of child migration around the world, how it affects both migrants and the rest of us, as well as the complex instruments and strategies needed to protect this highly diverse group of children and young adults. Joshua Green is a professor of psychology at Harvard and the director of Harvard's Moral Cognition Lab. With a background in philosophy and neuroscience, Professor Green does pathbreaking work studying moral judgment and decision-making, using original behavioral experiments and a functional neuroimaging, or fMRIs. In his book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them, published last year by Penguin, he employs this unique methodology to show us how different parts of the brain, those that are responsible for emotional reactions and those that control rational reasoning, affect the choices we make and the positions we adopt. Crucially, he argues that overcoming our emotional gut feeling or gut intuitions and employing reason instead is the only way society can curb its tribal tendencies and the us versus them mentality. Timothy Phillips is a social and economic entrepreneur who has launched several innovative organizations, both in the profit and nonprofit sectors, addressing crucial and emerging global problems. In 1992, he co-founded Beyond Conflict, a pioneering and widely respected conflict resolution reconciliation organization that made important contributions to the consolidation of peace and democracy around the world. Beyond Conflict, Lessons from 20 Years of Putting Experience to Work for Peace is the title of his edited volume, where he and six other leaders who brought change and hope to struggling communities around the world share their insights and lessons and urge us all to think optimistically about the possibilities of peace, even where conflict seems intractable. So with this, I invite Professor Baba to begin her five-minute presentation.
Thank you very much, Gabi, and it's a pleasure to be here and to have this opportunity of a conversation about repairing the world. I think it's hard to imagine a time when this wasn't more urgently needed. We are confronted daily with the spectacle of serious human rights violations, both here in this country and across the globe. My book just addresses one element of those human rights violations, but actually turns out to be quite a broad element, namely the part of sort of the repair that concerns children who migrate. And When I started working on this, it seemed like quite a narrow theme, and in fact, most people really weren't sure that there was a whole book's worth of topic about it, because they thought, well, surely most children migrate with their parents, and, you know, what's to be said about this? But as it turns out, hundreds of thousands of children migrate alone every year for a range of reasons, and my book explores three different broad categories of reason why children migrate alone. Maybe I can just very briefly outline these categories and then say a little bit about my thinking about them. So the first broad category is children who move for family, and this might be what you would consider the main bulk of child migration. Children, for example, left behind by immigrant parents who then try to join them, or children left in refugee camps who then move to meet their parents, or children who are maybe citizens, like citizens of the US, whose parents are not and whose parents are deported. So children are then, so to speak, deported to be with their parents in another country, or children who are brought in as transnational adoptees to make a family or have a new family. So that's one big category that I look at. The second category of child migration that I consider is what I call migrating for exploitation. And these are children very much attended to in our media, and increasingly familiar, I think, even to those of us living in this part of the world. Children maybe who are recruited as child soldiers, about 300,000 of them at present, and children who are forced to migrate for reasons of exploitation, both labor and sexual. So again, a very large number of children. So I explore some of the issues connected with that type of exploitative migration and look at the specificities that affect children, you know, clearly different from adults in some ways. And then my last book part is called Migrating for Survival. And there I look at child refugees, children who are fleeing persecution, fleeing war, fleeing conflict, fleeing disaster, and children who are migrating for survival, economic survival or hope or some sense of having a future. So that's the broad scheme of the book. Let me just say a couple of general comments about why I wrote it. And I definitely did write it to repair the world. It was very much an activist project. And I think the initial impetus for the book came from my own work as a practicing lawyer years ago, where it struck me as paradoxical that children, particularly migrant children, who are often alone, often in a new space, unfamiliar with the language, unfamiliar with the society, that these children should get what seemed like a particularly bad deal from states, from entities that were really meant to protect them. It struck me as paradoxical that these vulnerable, innocent migrants should really fare worse than their adult counterparts. I couldn't understand why it was that delays in their cases were longer, and administrative discretion more stingy, and detention centers awful. So it was seemed to me like a paradox and something that needed explaining. And as I pondered this in a range of different contexts, both in Europe and in the US, and now if we think about Syria, in the context of refugee children elsewhere too, I tried to look at an explanation for this paradox. And the general explanation that's out there seemed to me inadequate. The general explanation is that children do badly because they are invisible. They don't have a political voice, they're not politically organized, they don't have a constituency that, you know, demonstrates or lobbies on their behalf, and therefore they tend to fall between the cracks. And while in some cases that's true, it struck me as an inadequate explanation, because actually child migration problems are pretty visible. And of course, in this country, we've seen that very clearly over the last months. So what is a better explanation? This actually might link up with Josh's book. My argument is that children do so badly when at the mercy of states, if you like, because our responses to them are ambivalent. We're caught on the one hand between an inclination to be protective and to see children, other people's children, like our own children, as vulnerable, as innocent, as deserving of protection. But on the other hand, we're suspicious and hostile and often punitive. And I think if you look at any child migration situation, you'll see this kind of contradictory dance between these two different stances. You'll see certainly goodwill, you'll see sympathy and empathy, but you'll also see remarkable xenophobia, remarkable hostility. So you just need to think about, for example, the centers in which the unaccompanied child migrants from Central America have been housed in the months of this year, during which we've seen this so-called surge of, you know, 60 to 80,000 minors. You just have to look at the detention centers to see how harsh they are. They are really like jails. They're not child welfare homes. They're not protective spaces. And the people who run them similarly are like guards and prison officers rather than social workers and child welfare workers. So my final point really is, how do we repair this? How do we address this rather than just wringing our hands in dismay? And what my book tries to do is to suggest a mixture of strategies. As a human rights lawyer, of course, I do refer often to legal strategies. I refer to international and domestic law and to some successes in case law. But I often find that framework disappointing and deficient, great at kind of bold enunciations, but actually very weak on the ground. And so I think my argument is that we really need, of course, advocacy, we need organizing, we need to really highlight the extent to which rights-respecting and dignified solutions benefit everybody. They create a future constituency of millennials and post-millennials who are integrated, who have a future, rather than angry, marginalized, and disadvantaged young people who really hope for nothing good from their future. So those are some of the arguments I put forward in my book.
Josh.
First, thank you so much for coming. Thanks so much for having me. I'm going to try to do 400 pages in 5 minutes. We'll see how this goes. So the basic idea of the book can be summarized this way. There are two kinds of moral problems. There are two kinds of moral thinking, and progress depends on matching the right kind of thinking with the right kind of problem. So let's break that down. What are the two kinds of moral problems? The basic problem of morality is the problem of me versus us, or me versus you. It's self-interest versus the interest of others. And I think that our moral psychology, both biologically and culturally, is designed to overcome that problem, to get people to care not just about themselves, but to care about the people around them. That's the basic problem. The more complicated moral problems that divide us are not about me versus us. They're not about selfishness versus morality. They're about competing visions of morality. So when you have different groups that disagree about things like abortion or what's to be done in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, although some people may cast it this way, these are not really about morality versus immorality. They're about one group's version of morality or justice or fairness or history versus another group's. Those problems are much more complicated, and I think our minds, both by biologically and to a large extent culturally, are not very well designed to deal with those, and they require a special kind of uncomfortable thinking. So that's the two different kinds of problems, two different kinds of thinking. How many of you have read or at least heard of Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow? Okay, I see some hands going up. So the idea is that, at least my way of describing it, is our brains are like a SLR digital camera. So you've got your automatic settings, your landscape mode or your portrait mode, point and shoot, and you've got your manual mode where you can adjust the camera, you can adjust the f-stop and everything by hand. Now, why does the camera have both of these things? Well, the idea is that most of the time you just need point and shoot. You want a system that's efficient and it doesn't have to be very flexible because the manufacturer already knows what you want. Why does it have manual mode? Well, the manufacturer can't anticipate everything. Sometimes you have unusual interests or needs, or you're in a weird situation and you want to do exactly what you want to do. And so that gives you flexibility, but at the cost of efficiency. And the human brain works the same way, which is why we have both fast and slow thinking. We have gut reactions that work well most of the time, and then we have our ability for reflection. And so to come back to that original idea, two kinds of problems and two kinds of thinking, what's the right matchup? And I want to describe a couple of lab experiments that illustrate, I think, the way in which we can get the right kind of thinking or the wrong kind of thinking for the situation. So one of these lab experiments done with myself, David Rand, and Martin Novak uses something called the public goods game. You bring in, say, four people into the lab. Everybody gets, let's say, $10. And everybody can choose to either keep their money or put it into a common pool. Or split the difference. And whatever goes into the common pool gets doubled by the experimenter and then evenly divided among everybody. So if you're completely selfish, what do? You keep your $10. Other people may put money in. It gets doubled. It gets divided up. And you get your 10 plus your share of whatever other people put in. If what you really care about is us, the total take for the group, then you put all of your money in because that maximizes the amount that gets doubled by the experimenters. So we have people play this, and some people put in their money and some people don't. And the psychological question is why? Does fast thinking make people do this, or does slow people thinking make people do this? So to test that, we looked at people's reaction times. And it turns out that around here at least, the faster people respond, the more likely they are to contribute. And if you force people to respond more quickly, they contribute more. And if you force people to stop and think longer, they contribute less. Now, you might take away from this, oh, so this means that we're hardwired to be good or something like that. But it's actually more complicated. Not everybody shows this effect. It's only the people who report trusting the people that they interact with in their daily lives who show this effect. The people who said, I don't trust the people around here, their first thought is to keep the money, and then their second thought is to keep the money. And so they don't have any difference between the fast and slow thinking, right? And in fact, if you look around the world, so Benedict Herman and colleagues, for example, have had people play this public goods game, this cooperation game in different cities around the world. And the same people will play multiple games, and they can punish each other economically. I pay $1 to make you lose $3 if you don't like the way someone else is playing. And what you find is that in places like Boston and Copenhagen, people cooperate right from the start, and they keep their cooperation going, and they walk away with a lot of money. In places like Athens or Riyadh, people don't put in a lot of money and contributions stay very low. And in fact, in some of those places, people who don't contribute will punish the people who contributed. Why? And so the experimenters ask them this, say, why are you punishing these people who are giving you money and trying to, you know, do this for the group? And they say, I don't know who you are. I don't know who these people are. I don't trust you. I don't like this whole setup. Now, it's not that people in Athens aren't nice. Been to Athens, they're perfectly nice, but they're not as comfortable overall compared to people in Copenhagen, let's say, with just walking into a room with a bunch of strangers and putting their money on the line in hopes that they're going to have a good cooperative outcome. So it's really a function of trust, and trust is largely a function of whether or not you have a culture that's not only cooperative, but cooperative in a more global kind of way. So what this experiment in the lab here and around the world illustrates is that we can have cooperative instincts, but we can also have situations in which our instincts fail us. I want to give another example of a modern moral problem where our instincts fail us. This is a version of a thought experiment done as a real experiment. The original one comes from the philosopher Peter Singer. So we asked people, this is myself and Jay Musin, suppose you are vacationing in this lovely faraway country that's very poor. You have your little cottage up in the mountains, and there's a typhoon that hits. You can see the coast below the mountains is devastated. People desperately need food and water, etc. And you can help. You can make a donation to an international relief effort that's already on the ground. And your internet's still working. You can just make a donation right online. Do you have an obligation to help the people who are devastated by this typhoon below? And in our sample, 60% of people said, yes, you have to give something. We asked a different, essentially identical group of people. We described the situation with the typhoon and the coast and the mountains, and he said, but you're not there. Your friend is there. and your friend has a smartphone and is showing you video of everything that's going on, you know everything your friend knows, and you can make a donation just as well as your friend can, do you have an obligation to give something? In this sample, about 30% of people said they have an obligation to help. So, same exact problem. You have all the information. You can help just as much, but thinking of it as over there makes you about half as likely to be willing to help. Now, we can look at that and say, that doesn't make any sense. But from a biological perspective, it makes a lot of sense. We didn't evolve to cooperate with people on the other side of the world. We evolved to cooperate with the people around us. And so, putting these experiments together, the first is an example of where our fast thinking helps. People intuitively contribute to the group if it's a context in which they feel familiar, if they feel comfortable. If you look at places like Athens, where people are cooperative, but not with strangers, then the intuition isn't there. And if you look at our attitudes towards helping people on the other side of the world, simply thinking of them as far away, we don't have that gut response that says, of course, I have to do something. So then the question is, okay, well, what can we do about this? If our fast thinking sort of helps in a limited context, but not more broadly, what can we do? And I think the answer is we need slow thinking. We need a kind of manual mode way of dealing with these more complicated global problems beyond the life within a tribe. Philosophers have been thinking about this for several centuries. I think that some philosophers have had better ideas about this than others. I spend the second half of my book defending one of these philosophies. I'm not going to defend it now, but I'll give you an example of, I think, the kind of progress that we can make if we're willing to put our gut reactions aside when it comes to modern moral problems. So one of the first people to defend what we now call gay rights is a philosopher who some of you have probably heard of named Jeremy Bentham. He was kind of an eccentric guy, and he has a philosophy that has a terrible name called utilitarianism. And he said, it seems to me, it's clear to me that there's something terrible about being gay, but when I actually think about what is the harm here, what's the problem, I can't really think what it is. So maybe it's actually not so bad. And this was, he wrote this in the late 18th century at a time when this was just bonkers. This was just considered crazy. How could you say that it's okay to be in a gay relationship, if you even would call it that? And the way he was able to get, I think, 2 centuries ahead of his time morally was by not trusting his gut reactions and thinking in more of a manual mode. I'll leave it at that, but just to sort of put all of this together, I think that when it comes to the morality of everyday life, we have our biology and our culture working toward, with us, helping us contribute to the group, not lie, not steal, etc. As much bad stuff happens, a lot more, it could be a lot worse. But when it comes to the problems that divide us, the problems that we face here at home, that we disagree about, things like abortion, or the problems that face the world, climate change, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, etc., that's where we really have to learn to distrust our instincts. And the way forward is, I think, to build a kind of more global philosophy that's independent of the values of any particular tribe. And as a result of doing that, find a way to build the trust that's necessary to repair the world.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank Jackie and Josh for sharing the platform with me. And I have to pick up briefly on what Josh was saying about trust and cooperation. And as I heard you sort of mention those two words and those two challenges, it occurred to me that's at the core of the work that we do. And I think it's really central to the problems we're facing in the world today. Our book, Beyond Conflict, tells the story of not only 6 individuals who have really struggled with profound change, who have sought to overcome deep mistrust and try to find a way to not only cooperate with each other, but live with each other. And in many countries, after doing horrible things or living through horrible periods of repression or conflict. And let me just say, as a background, the book grew out of the work that Beyond Conflict has done for about 23 years. Started in Eastern Europe in 1991, and because we sort of started at a point at the end of the Cold War where we saw these succeeding transitions happening around the world, we ended up working in Central America, Northern Ireland, a bit in South Africa, the Balkans, wherever there was a problem for the most part. And it was founded with a very simple notion, that people can learn from the experience of others. And it's not a very simple thing, recognizing there are profound differences in countries around the world. But if I, as I said back in 1991, and I understand that the first real neuroimage was done in 92, I said, intuitively, I said, you know, people don't respond to the legacy of trauma and repression with their national identity card. They respond as humans. That culture, trauma, race, ethnicity, all the things that we often ascribe as to the reasons why people act the way they do, sits on an operating system, the human brain. And once you get past these surface differences, you start to see that people have a lot in common. People are afraid to compromise. In many countries around the world, there's no word for compromise. They're afraid of disloyalty to their parents or their family who have suffered, disloyalty to a political class that says these people are our enemies, and they have, you know, brought havoc to our country and to our people for generations, if not longer. And what we wanted to do, starting in 1991, is in these unfolding transitions in the post-communist world, and then in these other countries, is bring in people, and not just those who won, the dissidents who built democracies, or the people who overcame, conflict, but adversaries, people who negotiated with each other, former guerrilla commanders, dissidents, military, civil society, because all of them constitute a society in change and transformation. And what we did is, you know, struggled initially with the notion among funders that people can't learn from the experience of others. And then going into societies where one of the things we learned is that people who have been traumatized or victimized feel that they can't learn from others, that nobody will understand their suffering. And what we found over these years is that people can learn, and they can see that, that change is possible. So that's a bit of the background. And what we did in this book is we selected six leaders we had worked with. And I'll give you just two examples. One of them, Rolf Meyer, was the chief negotiator in the talks to end apartheid for F.W. de Klerk. But more importantly, he was the man who convinced de Klerk to release Nelson Mandela from prison. He had been Minister of Defense, he had been Minister of Police, and the chapter of this was recognizing the need for change. And the question was, how do you go, as he described, growing up in apartheid South Africa and thinking it was not only good for whites but for blacks, to then going through a process of transformation to realize that this is a deeply corrupt and immoral system that had to end? And what we try to do with all of these chapters is take these leaders who, through their leadership and work and real perspiration, there's no, you know, easy victory in all these stories. In many cases, they say, here's the struggle that we still have today, is how did they go through that process? And in Rolf's case, he describes that not only being in government, but one occasion when he was Minister of Defense, he was interviewing a captured ANC combatant. And he asked him, he said, why did you join the guerrilla movement? And he said that when he was 6 or 7 years old, his family worked for an Afrikaner farmer. And one day he was in the back of the farmer's truck with the farmer's dog, and it started to downpour. And the farmer pulled over, got out, and took the dog and put it in the front seat and left the kid in the back. And that so shocked Rolf's just basic sense of decency. He said, this system has to end. And he describes that he went through a paradigm shift where F.W. de Klerk went through a pragmatic shift, that it really changed the core of his identity and his narrative. And it'd be really interesting to understand from a neuroscience point of view, how is it that this farmer can show empathy for his dog, but not for a six-year-old child? And I think, you know, these cross currents of experience and science could be very interesting. And one other example is Jan Urban, who with Vaclav Havel was one of the founders of the Czech dissident movement. And Jan grew up a privileged son of communist parents who were real heroes during the Second World War and then during the early days of communism in Czechoslovakia. And he came to realize that this system was corrupt and had to end. And he became one of the leading dissidents. He was in prison, tortured. His father died being tortured when they were trying to get information on where Jan was hiding. And this was 2 years before the wall came down. And Jan talks about, in a very personal term, what dictatorship or repression does to individuals and communities. And one of the sort of resonant themes is he talks about people becoming victims. And when you're a victim, you lose all agency. You're above reproach, that this isn't your fault. And I've seen more people in this community read this chapter and say, well, I can connect with that. That's a human experience. And I think that's what we wanted to do in this book, is to connect to the human experience. And also, in a more positive note, when we look at what's happening in the world today, you know, people say, you know, is this the worst of human nature that we repeat time and time again? Or can people change? And, you know, we are wired as a species to stay the same. But when you speak to Rolf Meyer or read his chapter and recognize, I mean, this is a man who grew up thinking apartheid was good for blacks, to being the man who dismantled it. Then you have Jan Urban, grew up the privileged child of communist parents, who then worked to dismantle that. And one of the really interesting anecdotes in his chapter, in 1989, 3 months before the transition in Czechoslovakia, all of the Solidarity top leaders came to Prague. And there was still a communist government in Czechoslovakia. And you may know a man named Adam Michnik, who was one of the real fathers of the Solidarity movement. He said to Jan, looking up at the communist red hammer and sickle, he said, this will be gone in months. And Jan said, oh, we're so different here in Czechoslovakia. We're not like you Poles. We didn't have that big movement. You know, things are very different. And he said, within 3 weeks, the government collapsed and we were forming a new administration. So what we, you know, I guess in summary, I don't know where we are, but what we try to do is show through the experience of people that change was not only possible, but the hard-earned lessons that it takes time. And it's about courage. And when you think about trust, one of the things they all say throughout the different chapters from different countries, that trust is not necessary for negotiation, but that trust can be built. And one of the key ways to build trust, and this is purely based on their experience and seeing it in other countries, is that people have to be recognized for how they see themselves. People have to feel that their identities, and even if that identity doesn't reflect reality, but it's how they see their reality, that has to be acknowledged by the adversary on the other side. And only then can people feel safe. And again, it's interesting to tie it to brain science about how we're wired for feeling safe. We're wired for survival. And it seems to me that one of the key ways that we can even think rationally is when we feel safe, and feeling safe is a result of feeling understood as we see ourselves. And I think that's one of the key lessons is about building trust, is to recognize that it's a process. So with that, I think I'll end. Thank you.
Wonderful. As you can see, we have quite a lot here to discuss. Jackie, let me start with you. One of the things I found wonderful about all three books is that they are very prescriptive. There is not just identifying phenomena or talking about them, but there are recommendations, and real-life recommendations. And one of the things I was struck by in your book is, which I never thought about, is how diverse this group of children and young adults are, and why we could not, it would be wrong to try and think about it in sort of uniform ways with uniform strategies. So can you elaborate a little more about how the typology that you offer also calls for very different strategies and why that makes things much more complicated?
Yeah, thank you, Gabi. I think one of the points I make is that just to back up for 1 second, is that even though I make these nice, clear tripartite distinctions, of course, human conduct is always multifactorial. So it is, to some extent, an arbitrary division. So children who move, say, for exploitation might end up also moving for survival and so on. So that, you know, or children who are refugees might also have some sort of sense of moving for economic possibilities. So I try to qualify this rigid distinction, but you're absolutely right. There certainly are different strategies that I advocate and that I explore, partly because I mean, this is interestingly relates to what you're saying, Josh. With the material I work with, I'm not so sure actually that, what you said about being maybe more wired to be engaged or sympathetic or collaborative with what's nearby is really manifests itself. In fact, sometimes it's the opposite, that it's this what they call the NIMBY problem, not in my backyard. So if there are problems elsewhere, you can be quite generous and you can import problems elsewhere into your own living room with television and feel very involved. But if, say, migrant children are coming and living right in your own street, and there's a sense that your own children's school might be crowded with children who don't speak English and that, a whole set of resources are going to be allocated to these others, your sympathy levels might really plummet. So I think that one of the prescriptions, therefore, is to look in local contexts and local regulations and laws at how change can happen and how some of the principles that we hold dear about non-discrimination and equality and children's best interests being important, how those can be imported into situations where there really is an exclusionary kind of sometimes nativist instinct. So the argument that I make there is that really we need to take at face value some of the principles that we adhere to and fight them through and expose the sort of contradictions in the way we practice. In situations further afield, I think we need to try to make parallels between situations which seem very alien and situations which seem much closer. So, for example, in the chapter on adoption, I explore the tension between people who think that transnational adoption is really a completely unqualifiedly positive way of helping some of the world's most disadvantaged children stuck in awful institutions with no love and attention, people who have that perspective, and I contrast that with the perspective of people who think that transnational adoption is really a form of sanitized child trafficking, a way of transporting brown and black babies from poor mothers to the homes of wealthy families who've maybe waited too long to reproduce naturally. So there is this polarizing the difference, but there are these two very different perspectives. And what I try to argue there is that some of the principles that we seem to have incorporated successfully in domestic adoption and domestic thinking about, the complexity of families and the multiple ways in which family life can now be organized, those same principles could be applied to the transnational arena. So very specifically, in the domestic context, we really now take seriously the value of what's called open adoption, the value of a child who's adopted, having the possibility of tracking down his or her parents later in life. In the international context, that's impossible. On the contrary, the whole idea is that it has to be a sort of rigid closure so that there's no kind of danger of contamination, if you like. And so I ask, well, why is that? Why is there this contradictory set of principles? So on the one hand, trying to exploit local domestic provisions to show up our contradictions, and on the other hand, I think I try to argue that we need to make parallels between what seems very far away or removed and what we do within our own domestic sphere to see the commonalities. So those are some of the ideas I explore. And the last thing I'll say is that a constant theme in the book is that we've moved a long way from the Victorian idea that children, even migrants and other people's children, should just be seen and not heard. And we now have a set of principles incorporated into international law, which says that children, of course, are also agents. And as children mature and grow up, so they are and should be entitled to have a voice and to be listened to, not necessarily listened to the point of being followed in what they want, but certainly to have a say. And in many of the areas I look at, that doesn't happen at all. And so a point that I make again and again is how important it is to actually create a framework in which child migrants' views about what's in their best interests can be explored. Is it really in the best interests of a child simply to be reunified with family if family is abusive, or if family is destitute, or if family is completely disintegrating? So let's interrogate some of our basic gut or quick thinking reactions and incorporate some of the principles that we now have evolved. That's some of the points that I make.
So Josh, the story that Tim tells is a very emotional story, or a very sort of one of personal connections, and actually reading the descriptions are wonderfully moving descriptions in the book about how leaders come talk to rebels or gang members from remote places, and just something about that shared experience of past trauma causes them to listen in ways that they haven't listened before. And that sounds much more sort of an emotional type of bonding than a reason-based type of bonding. What's going on?
So I think you can have emotion without reasoning, but you can't have reasoning without emotion. So I think that the philosopher David Hume got it right a couple of centuries ago when he said, reason doesn't have any ends of its own. What reason can do is allow you to connect the moment that you're facing right here to some more distant goal that's not immediately pressing your buttons. I mean, to take probably the most familiar example, like dieting, right? I mean, we think of, you know, not having the chocolate cake so that we can have, you know, have the body we want to have a year from now. That's the rational thing to do. But of course, you have to want to be that way instead of this way, and that's ultimately an emotional thing. So I don't think that it's reason versus emotion, but rather more automatic, immediate impulses versus motivations that are tied to larger but more distant goals. And I think that what happens in those meetings, not that I'm there, but my best guess is that on the one hand, people come in with a lot of very strong and raw feelings about how they've been victimized, about how they have to stand up not only for themselves, but for the people they love and their family and their friends and the groups with which they identify. And all of those things are making it very difficult for them to do anything that could be seen as disloyal or compromising, right? Then you spend some time with someone on the other side, and a new set of feelings starts to develop, where you say, okay, in some ways I can see that this is a person too, and that they have their perspective, and I don't necessarily agree with them about everything, right? And so you have competing feelings, right? And then this sets the stage for some kind of rational thinking about this, right? This sets the stage for you to go back and talk to your people and say, you know, I met this person and I see things a little bit differently now. Don't worry, I'm still one of us. Don't worry, I still think we're the most important thing in the world, but, right? So a rational process of reconciliation and taking risks for the sake of a better future, that's not a purely reasoned process. It's a matter of taking the emotions that either are non-existent or very weak to begin with, and giving them the support they need so that they can prevail in a process that ultimately can make things better for everybody.
Right. So Tim, Joshua's call is very universal. It's to the entire humankind how to adopt certain types of thinking and what should be better. You work with leaders, both those that made the change and both, I assume, some that strayed much more recalcitrant. What makes an effective leader of a change? What differentiates those that do actually transform and those that don't?
That's the ultimate question. I think it's curiosity. I think in some ways, and I'm not saying this to be sort of, not politically incorrect, but not be serious, but imprisonment. A time to be reflective. Look at Nelson Mandela. He spent 27 years in prison on Robben Island. And even though he was living in the worst of the apartheid existence in prison, in many ways, unlike his wife, Winnie, who is day in, day out living with, you know, the trauma of the social reality of apartheid South Africa, of people coming to her suffering, of the doors being broken down, people killed. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, he had very little in common with his wife. And they both lived in the worst of apartheid South Africa, but I think what Nelson Mandela had going for him, in a sense, was the capacity to be really self-reflective and to recognize, as he said, that they could take away my freedom, my family, but they couldn't take away my mind. And also, by being in prison, the people he engaged with more often were the Afrikaner guards, and he began to humanize them, and they humanized him. His family and many other people in the ANC and the liberation movement never had that experience. And so when he came out of prison, it isn't that he went in there as this great figure, you know, of reconciliation and let's all be inclusive. I think the imprisonment forced him to become a different person, almost to find his more authentic self. If you look at Yasser Arafat, he spent all his time in exile. And when it came to the second Good Friday, not the Good Friday Agreement, mixing peace agreements, the Camp David, he couldn't bring himself to cut a deal. And there are different examples of those leaders who had the capacity to really stand back. And I think what you were saying, I asked a colleague neuroscientist of yours recently, if you think of fear as a deeply emotional response governed by the amygdala in milliseconds, and that's how we've, you know, evolved through evolution as a survival instinct. And then you think of imagination and vision as something that requires rational thought. A colleague neuroscientist of yours said, the only way we can have a vision of the future, as you said, is to connect with our emotion, is to connect with the hippocampus where memories are stored and rearrange those in the service of a different future. So I think it's those leaders who do that that really lead their countries in the right direction. But they can do it. And I think seeing that others have done it can be empowering.
And is there something not maybe paradoxical, but I want to pose that as a question.
Right.
We think about the importance of accountability and accountability to populations and societies. You work and you focus very much on leaders and leadership. What happens when a leader wants to make that move but has a constituency that is not there?
Well, I'll make two distinctions. One, when we say leaders, it's not just sort of elites. It's all through the society. Anybody that does something that contributes or is a leader. So we work at different levels. It's one of the big challenges. Some political movements tend to do it much better because out of necessity, look at Sinn Féin or the IRA in Northern Ireland. They had to structure as an organization for physical survival against in a war, to be very closely structured, to be always communicating with each other, to prevent the spoilers and others going off or being picked up by the British intelligence services. And while that did happen, they were very good at not taking steps until they got everybody along. And there are other movements that fail to do that. And one of the things I've heard people, for example, we take the South Africans today, some of the ANC leaders and Rolf Meyer and others from the de Klerk government, they'll say that when you enter into a peace process and the leaders who are negotiating are really making progress, they have to remember that they have to unravel the narrative on the other side. And sometimes that means feeding the dogs. Sometimes there'll be violence, there'll be bombings, there'll be assassinations or things because they need to start to bring their constituency along in this process. And it's a horrible thing, but that's the nature of change.
Jackie, I want to ask you, going back to your background as an international lawyer and as one international lawyer to another, you know, people are very skeptical, obviously, of international law, but your book details a lot of ways in which it was tremendously helpful. And one reason I want to ask you about this is that Josh has this great line in the book, rights are not for making arguments, they're for ending arguments. So that the reliance on rights in some ways denies or restricts compromise, makes it much harder to talk about the issues behind the rights. Can you say more about the experience of international law, in what ways it was helpful, in what ways maybe inhibited change? Or
I think both. It has the potential to make change, and also it can inhibit or stall change. So international law, as you know very well, Gabi, is not. It comes in many shapes and sizes, depending on the jurisdiction in which it's invoked. So you have an international framework, but then it's typically enforced or called upon in a particular national context. And so certainly in the field that I work in, which is in immigration refugee law, which is what my book's about, that international law framework is sort of domesticated to be used, because there aren't really...
So this is for George. So beyond, say, the Wes Anderson film, I guess this is a two-part question. Why was Zweig so thoroughly disappeared, certainly in the English-speaking world, and maybe beyond Wes Anderson, why is he having a resurgence now?
Right. Well, one thing that's important to remember with Zweig's disappearance is he disappeared here, and he disappeared to an extent in England. But in France and in Brazil, he never stopped being a huge seller. And to this day, you can find Zweig in airport carousels in France. They keep reissuing the novellas in their bestsellers. So what made him vanish from the American publishing scene, although he'd been a bestseller here as well, I think there are a few different explanations for that. But the quickest one, at least, is his values were associated partly for the reasons that I've already been touching on in terms of the melancholia and the resignation, with a whole pastiche of ideals of a Europe that was seen as a dead experiment. And I think to that extent, you might even say he succeeded too well. This was not what post-World War II America particularly wanted to focus on. I think that there was a gap there that the kinds of images of Habsburg-era romances, however psychologically complex they were not recognized as being as psychologically, harrowing as they actually were. And he also had some bad luck in terms of his publisher, etc., in the immediate aftermath of his death. His suicide was enormously controversial. And a number of important emigres in the United States made big public pronouncements against it as a surrender to Nazism. They felt here, you know,
Thomas Mann among them, right?
Sorry?
Thomas Mann.
Thomas Mann was particularly outraged. You know, the idea was this man, who in fact did not suffer anything like the material hardships that so many refugees did, who continued to be sell enormously well in different parts of the world. What did it mean for him to surrender that way, to give up life? Now, in fact, when you read his correspondence in the final years, you see how tired he was, how beaten down, how convinced he was that everything he cared most about was gone. And even if it might be resurrected at some point, it was too late for him. He was 60 years old, etc. But coming around to the second part of the question, I do think when you pick up his novellas, they have they're limpid. They move very swiftly. It's one of the reasons he's been so popular for cinematic adaptation. This doesn't exactly apply to the Wes Anderson film because of the ways that that's a more of a montage of his life and certain themes of his fictions. But there's a way in which Zweig exists, I think, to the extent that it exists in people's imagination, like the Wes Anderson film, in terms of the confectionery dandy aesthetic. But the stories are dark. They're dark and fast, and there's a very contemporary feeling brutality to the ways that they end up. So I think the ways that they're extremely digestible, you can just page through them. They're not layered like Joyce. Or even, and the language, he was sometimes sloppy, unlike Fitzgerald, and certainly unlike Joyce both. He's, you know, he was an extremely fast and in the eyes of his detractors, facile writer. I don't think that's fair in the end, and I think there are a handful of his works, particularly his last novella, which he wrote just months before his suicide, about chess, which I think can be read as an allegory for Vienna and the death of a certain vision of the imagination, that are real masterpieces. But he also wrote a lot of schlock, and he wrote a lot. You know, he wrote so much that it hurt him, I think, in terms of his sustainability. There's shelfuls of biographies and histories. And
on a scale of 1 to 10, how good is his biography of Freud?
It's not quite a biography, so I think it wouldn't be fair to judge him entirely on that, but it is one of the earliest attempts to look at what his theories were. And I think it was... no one had done what he did with Freud as early as he did it.
Worth reading? I mean, does it illuminate Freud today?
Here and there, okay. Would be my garden.
Please. Blue shirt, gent.
Term Gatsby was writing the great American novel. Could you say more what that big term means in terms of, I mean, Fitzgerald writing it to Fitzgerald and other writers that you think are seeking that?
Yeah, sure. Fitzgerald is exploring the American dream of the meritocracy. And Gatsby has it both ways. Gatsby says the American dream is a mirage, but it describes that dream to us in language that's so beautiful it makes the dream irresistible. You know, Gatsby said, the novel, Gatsby says, aspiration is a worthy quality in its main character. Aspiration is something to admire, and it also tells us that those who aspire are going to inevitably sink. So it's such a complicated and complex novel because it wants to believe in the American dream, and yet at the same time it tells us that the game is rigged. I think Fitzgerald, you know, Fitzgerald was a huge fan of John Keats, the romantic poet. And Keats is the poet who gives us the idea of negative capability, to be able to live with doubts, uncertainties, to be able to hold two opposing ideas in your head at the same time. I think Fitzgerald did that with the American dream. He wanted to believe in it, and at the same time, he tells us that it's really all a hallucination.
Please. On the aisle. Thank you.
We heard a bit about the rebirth of Zweig and the rebirth after the banning of Ulysses. I'm wondering about the rebirth story after those Gatsby novels were stuck in the warehouse as remainders.
Yeah, the short version of that story is Fitzgerald dies, age 44 in Hollywood. His well-placed literary friends, people like Edmund Wilson, Malcolm Cowley, of course, Maxwell Perkins, his editor, Dorothy Parker, they work very hard to get Fitzgerald back out there in the bookstores, bring out new editions of Gatsby, of the short stories. Edmund Wilson brings out an edition of the last novel that Fitzgerald was working on that he never finished, The Loves of the Last Tycoon, his Hollywood novel. But that's the Fitzgerald revival from the top down. There's also a fascinating story about the revival from the bottom up, and it has to do with World War II. These special paperbacks that were printed during World War II called the Armed Services Editions, that were these long rectangular paperbacks printed on pulp paper, distributed to soldiers and sailors serving overseas. Publishers, editors, paper manufacturers, librarians get together in New York. They want to do something for the war effort. So they decide on this idea of manufacturing armed services editions of everything from my friend Flicka to Moby Dick to the Odyssey to the latest Rex Stout novel to the Great Gatsby. So this novel that is moldering in Scribner's warehouse in 1940, by 1945, there are 155,000 copies of The Great Gatsby out there, soldiers and sailors reading them. They've got, you know, they don't have a huge choice in their reading material, so they're reading what they were given. You know, the Armed Services editions were meant to be read about seven times before they fell apart. And of course, after the war, then you get the paperback revolution. Gatsby is picked up by all the paperback houses, a TV, the movie, the second movie in 1949. There was a silent movie in 1926 that we've lost, but you can see a trailer of it. It looks great. So that's how Gatsby starts to come back in a big way.
Can I just say one sentence to that? Sure. Because it's actually a really important point, and I don't know if it's true also of Ulysses, but availability can't be, the importance of that can't be overstated. And in terms of this country, you know, New York Review Books Classics started reissuing those, and Wes Anderson said, you know, he happened upon Beware of Pity. Yeah. And then he said, why does no one know about these books? What it means to just have these books in circulation, which is why all of us should do everything we can to support small presses and to support presses in their more difficult works. It's just having it there, people often can makes it possible to discover the treasures that these works are.
A note for next year, we will be talking about the My Friend Flicka revival. please, who's near the mic? Where is the mic? Hand raised down here, please. And then redhead on this side next. Here.
Oh.
Okay.
Sorry. Hi, thank you all so much for your great talk. This is also a question about Fitzgerald and Gatsby, and just having read some of his biography, there's this sense that he dies, or said to have died, thinking that he's a failure, that he is in that exile in Hollywood. He's certainly not turning out fiction, and the last fiction, the novels that he had turned out were not as well received as The Side of Paradise or The Beautiful and the Damned. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious, though, he does write, I think, that cryptic letter to Max Perkins, and he asks, you know, maybe we should think about reissuing Gatsby. Yeah. I don't know. I think he says, I don't know if it's really gotten its due. And so part of me just sort of thinks that deep down, as an artist, as a writer, he knew what he had accomplished.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And was waiting for everyone to sort of, to come to him. He didn't have to go out, you know, he was more ahead of his time, and he was waiting for everyone to come around to his sensibility. So in light of that, what do you think of that statement that he dies thinking himself a failure?
He thought he was a failure in that he wasn't recognized. His greatest masterpiece was not recognized. That letter to Maxwell Perkins is so powerful. I quote it in the book, too, because it's so powerful. It's written 5 months before he dies. Mm. And he writes to Max Perkins, is there any way to get Gatsby back in print? He uses that phrase. Or is the book a failure? And, you know, he's saying that in italics. Is the book finished? And then he ends the letter by saying, but to die, basically, unappreciated, after having given so much, in some small way, I was an original. You know, it breaks your heart because, you know, Kevin mentioned Bennett Cerf a minute ago. Bennett Cerf was a great admirer of The Great Gatsby. And in the 30s, when Fitzgerald was out of fashion, because he wasn't a proletarian writer, he was out of step with the Great Depression. He wasn't writing about the struggling masses. He was writing about rich people, you know, not an audience. Bennett Cerf tries to get Gatsby back in print through his Modern Library editions, 1934. The Great Gatsby becomes the worst selling title in the Modern Library history. It doesn't even sell 500 copies in 1934. Now if you go on the Modern Library website, greatest novels, in English of the 20th century, Ulysses is first and the Great Gatsby is second. So it says something about sometimes writers, you know, they don't find their audience until after their death.
But they know. Beautifully stated question, too. A couple more. We're running out of time, but let's make the most of it.
A question for Marine again. You say current is a class element in The Great Gatsby. Do you think that contemporary theme of hunger is maybe born in The Great Gatsby?
Well, that's a wonderful way to phrase it. I think maybe we're talking about the same thing. Hunger, aspiration, yearning, trying to lift yourself up from where you started, and then the terror that you're going to fall down again. Those are elements certainly all within Gatsby. I mean, very, very, very explicitly, I think.
One more question, one more answer, please. The redhead in the front. Thank you.
Hi, this is Maureen. With Fitzgerald being so picky about changes being made to Gatsby, I know there was, I had read that it had been published while he was still making editorial changes to it. And there had originally been a copy, I think it was called Trimalcho.
Trimalcho. Yeah.
Do you think that if that original copy had been published, there would have been, it would have affected us the way that it does now, and it would have sustained us and been such a great American novel with those original changes?
No, I think it's a rough draft. You can read Trimalcho. It's been published. Yeah. Maybe we can talk after. I don't think it packs the punch. You know, the first time Fitzgerald wrote Gatsby, as you know, he didn't have Nick Carraway. He had a third person narrator, and Nick is a stroke of genius. That narrator who's partly involved, partly not involved. Fitzgerald got the idea for a Nick Carraway type narrator from another great modern, Joseph Conrad. You know, so that one foot out, one foot in type character. But you know, when you were talking about Joyce being so fierce about the words he wanted and the commas and everything else, fighting for them, Fitzgerald couldn't let it go. I looked at Fitzgerald's own copy of The Great Gatsby at Princeton, and after it's been published, he's making changes.
Mm. Yeah. The only reason why Ulysses was published when it was is because Joyce insisted on having it published for his 40th birthday. He was actually... He was born on February 2nd, and so February 2nd, 1922 was his 40th birthday. He made the last change to Ulysses on January 31st, and he had to send it. He telegraphed it to the printer because he couldn't stop doing it. And if he were born in December, he would have been writing through December. And it's just mania for writing.
Sorry? George, last word.
Last word is you.
They're giving us the hook, but it's been so much fun.
Well, let's make it a cliffhanger. And thank you for all your patience. And it was really wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You know, around Syria, with now millions of children not in school and so on, the more we are contributing to the growth of these movements, and the more we're really a part of that whole dynamic that we see as outside us. So these are not movements that are unresponsive to the inequalities and exclusions of our own society. That's really how I come to it. But how you engage with it politically, I think, is another issue.
I would have loved to continue this for 3 more hours, but I'm told I must stop. So please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.